Good day, my friends, and welcome to the Craig Shapiro Tennis Podcast. Today's show is brought to you by Diadora, brand made legendary by Bjorn Borg, currently worn by world number 28, Alejandro Davidovich Fokina, world number 26, Martina Trevisan. See them at Diadora.com. Today's guest grew up in Palm Coast, Florida, won the Wimbledon Juniors in 2015. In 2022, got to his career high of 17 in the world. He is an art collector and keeps his eye on fashion and is the tallest player on tour. He shared some controversial opinions about our sport, and we discussed it all. Riley Opelka is today's guest. My man, are you? You're in New York City? You're in Manhattan?
I'm in Manhattan, best city in the world.
Now, generally speaking, when I hear about an athlete who's on the mend who's in New York, they're going to see doctors. Are you there to see a doctor?
I'm not. No. Nope.
You're not.
Nope. New York's my favorite city in the entire world. I love being in New York. Love spending time. You know, obviously I'm injured right now. I have some downtime. It's a little bit faster, obviously, a much faster pace than where I live in Florida. I love art, and it just occupies my entire day. And, you know, I never get bored.
Gentlemen, you hear, former world number 17, was at that moment in time the top American player. He is 7'1". He is a fashion plate. Have you walked shows?
No.
You've never walked a show.
Clothes look funny on me, obviously. I'm, like you said, 7 foot. But I love fashion. It's been my intro to the art world for sure, which I think is cool.
I don't know why I had that wrong. For some reason, I feel like the pictures I see, it's you at the runway. No?
That's what Instagram does, man. It's a it's false reality we live in. But no, I was sat front row at Prada, and yeah, I popped up there for a quick pick at the end. That was kind of like a dream come true. I've always loved Prada, and their creative director now, Raf Simons, is a legend, absolute legend, one of my favorites ever. And that was an unbelievable experience for me. I literally just flew overseas for that show and was back home, you know, the next day.
Jet setter. Now, listen, as you know, we do a 5-set format. The first set is the off-the-court report. How has your rehab gone? And can you explain the injury?
Yeah, I have a little bit of a wrist problem right now. You know, it's not an easy process by any means. I came off a hip surgery, was ready to go, was expected to make my return at the Dallas Open. And, you know, this kind of came out of nowhere, and once my wrist heals up, I'll be, you know, hopefully in the best shape of my life.
So the hip is healed.
The hip is great.
Did you have to have a procedure?
Yeah, I had a procedure. I took a fall. I wiped out on court, and kind of just an awkward. It wasn't even a hard one. Very awkward sort of fall, and it, you know, you just wouldn't have expected it to have been, you know, that damaging, let's say. But I'll make a full recovery. There's no big concern. They didn't have to open up the joint. It was just outside of it, which, you know, is a, I guess, if you're looking at the brighter side of things, that's it. So I'll make a full recovery. Everything will be fine. I just got to be patient. The timing of it was unfortunate, given, you know, I just missed the US Open for my hip and the Australian Open. But, you know, it is what it is.
When do you come back?
You know, I'm going to be hopefully getting the racket in my hand in 2 months or so. And then, you know, it's hard to say, you know, I'm not putting a timeline. I want to make sure I'm ready and fit. And, you know, that's more important to me. I always look at my job, my career, almost everything I look at super long-term. Even tennis has taught me that. And I've applied it kind of everywhere in life, even with things I love, even when I'm buying clothes, fashion, even when I'm buying art, I always look super long term.
Have you had depression from the injuries, like being sidelined?
Yeah, not one bit. I've been in 4 museums this week and 6 galleries, and I've great friends, family, support around me. I'm doing great.
So you will be, you are out for the French. You're out for Wimbledon. Is that fair to say?
No, not necessarily, but it's just hard to say. It's hard to say. Yeah. I mean, French, I'm out, but what happens after that is you just don't know how everyone reacts to, especially wrist, you know, arm, elbow. Once you kind of shut that thing down for a couple months, you just never know, right? You never know what bumps could come in the road and how things can flare up. And like I said, I want to make sure that, you know, I'm playing my best tennis when I'm 30 years old.
Let's move into the second set. This is the On the Court Report. The Netflix show. You thought that it was an abject failure, and you questioned why they re-upped it for the second season. Can you explain your questions and concerns?
Yeah, I think mainly transparency. I mean, you look at the few sports that have done Netflix series now, or F1, golf, tennis. Tennis finished third by a mile. I don't get why, like, the truth is is controversial. I know it's an opinion, but I think it's not like a crazy radical thought that was a boring show. I thought it was, from the first episode, I thought it was horrible.
Why?
It was very basic, and they really, I felt they dumbed it down too much in the tennis aspect, and they weren't controversial. I'm kind of surprised almost to the extent that they share an F1, and you really get an inside look, and it's as transparent as can be. And I think that's key. And that's, it was as censored as you can imagine in tennis. I mean,
were you approached to shoot? Did you have them shoot and your footage hit the cutting room floor?
Come on, man. You know, I don't know who's in charge of that, but if it's anyone from the ATP, they're obviously likely not to pick me. I get that. But I had a little feature in a Fritz part. It didn't make the first season. I don't know if, I mean, maybe it'll be on the second season. It was, I don't know. It's what it is. It's a little scripted, huh?
Do you feel like the ATP media department is dictating the storylines too significantly, and that they should be leaning into the controversy on tour, leaning into those more nuanced stories?
Totally. I don't know who's dictating it. I have absolutely no idea. But if these are the same people that brought us the Drive to Survive, you wouldn't know. You know, it's a completely different format in that regard. I mean, I think we just have such a great product right now in tennis from men and women. I'm watching more WTA than ever. Obviously, I watched a lot of Venus and Serena growing up, but I mean, women are really good right now. Iga Swiatek's ridiculously good. Coco's, I mean, she's hitting these unbelievable shots. She's as good of an athlete as I've ever seen. The product's great, and the men's product is unbelievable as well. I think there's so much excitement. Anyone can kind of win right now. Medvedev might be the new Novak. Alcaraz might be the greatest thing we've ever seen. There's so much excitement just in those couple matches. I mean, look at how good Berrettini is. He's not even top 20 in the world.
Were you surprised at what Isla and Berrettini's hotel room looked like?
That's funny. I mean, I actually kind of find that funny about tennis. Novak staying where we stayed in Paris at the end of the year is, I mean, he could probably buy that hotel, you know? And
I do.
He doesn't even sweat it. It's not even, doesn't even cross the dawn on his mind. He's there to do business and win.
But you don't go into when you guys have your ATP meetings, you don't go in and say to Gaudenzi and these guys, hey man, this show is not good. What's going on here?
No, I haven't.
No,
I've never really been in a meeting. Even I think I've only met with Gaudenzi one time in person.
You've only talked with this guy once.
I've only talked with him one time. It was at the Miami Open during the COVID, the rough COVID year. I think that was my 2021 Miami Open. That was the only face-to-face sit-down I've ever had with Andrea.
What'd you guys talk about?
My concern was what was going on. I mean, the winner of the Miami Open in 2021 made the same amount of money as the winner in 1996. I mean, that's it's a big concern. You know, Roger, Rafa, Novak, they weren't there. I mean, obviously, we kind of know why they weren't there. You know, they're not going to go out and say it, but I said it. I'll say it. I'll take the fall for it, whatever. I don't care, but, I mean, they're not coming to play a Masters 1000 if the winner's making $200,000. It costs Roger more money to be there at that point than even if he wins the thing. You know what I mean?
You spoke to prize money. Prize money has increased significantly. Are you satisfied with what the regime has done, what the ATP has done?
A lot of times they like to, you'll see on the information sheet that a lot of those increases are from 2020, 2021. So a lot of the information is super manipulated, let's say. I mean, yeah, it's the Miami Open prize money is increased by however much percentage this year than 2021. It's up a huge number. But there's it's manipulated information. And a lot of the time, you know, it's increased prize money, but it's more, there's no new money. It's just repurposed, if that makes sense.
What is happening with PTPA?
I'm somewhat lost a little bit of touch with it. I still, you know, I think it's the right idea. We're the only sport. That's what's comical to me is like the PTPA was controversial. We're the only sport that doesn't have a players union, you know? Look at every other sport. It's like, I think it's controversial that we don't have a union and we still don't fully have a union. But honestly, I've been a little bit out of touch for no other reason than, you know, I've been occupied with art.
Is a LIV Golf situation on the horizon?
We'll see. I don't know. The LIV Tour came about and all of a sudden PGA found all this money. Right? Like instantly. Next thing you know, they're playing for similar purses as the LIV Tour. That's what competition does. We don't have a mechanism in place to extract it out of the ATP, for example, right now, but I don't think that PGA just came across all this money. They lost half their talent and then all of a sudden they find all this money out of nowhere. You know, it's an interesting thing to think about and you kind of wonder, but
Can you tell me your opinion of the speed of courts, the speed of hard courts right now, the quality of balls? Is this a real problem?
You don't, no doubt. I mean, guys are complaining about it a lot more now. I haven't been around the last 8 months, but I thought it was getting out of control. I mean, the slowest court I had ever played on in my life, any Wells is up there, but Laver Cup, I remember in Boston, it was just, hands down, without a doubt, the craziest condition I've ever played on. But a lot of the indoor tournaments have gone super slow. I think there should be some weeks where, you know, I think that's how the game evolves, right? That's how Rafa, if you put up Rafa's mind, Rafa's going to win no matter what, right? He's going to find a way to win no matter what. He doesn't like to lose. And you increase court speed, Rafa's going to learn how to serve better. Rafa's going to work on his first ball. Rafa might change his forehand grip a little bit to flatten it out if you speed up a court. And then the next week it's slower, blah, blah. That's how the game evolves, is by different conditions. That's exactly how tennis evolves as a whole, is by having different scenarios and some different conditions. I do think there should be times when, you know, I see Rafa in my draw, let's say, and I'm like, okay, you know, that's my quarter match. Matchup like where, you know, in Rome, it's their super slow clay court. You see Rafa in your quarter. And it's another thing. I think there should be some weeks where you're forced to evolve. And that's, you know, maybe you'll see more Cervalli. You'll see more variety. Not saying every time, but I think there totally needs to be more variety.
Rybakina said yesterday that she thought that the clay is faster than Indian Wells.
Yeah, she's spot on, especially when it's hot. There's, without a doubt, she's spot on.
What about the balls? What about different balls every week?
French Open might be faster than Wimbledon. Wimbledon's as slow as they come.
French Open might be faster than Wimbledon.
Yeah, I'd rather play at French Open than Wimbledon. I hold serve easier at the French Open on a hot day than Wimbledon.
Come on.
Wimbledon is insanely slow.
What about the balls? What about the ball chip, like a Dunlop ball, a Wilson ball, a Penn ball, a Slazenger ball? Is that a do you guys talk about the balls incessantly every week?
No. You know, we don't, and that's a concern of mine as well. It's a you know why they do why there's different balls. I mean,
cash money.
Yeah, it's not much. You know, it's like a couple grand at the 250s and 500s. Literally a couple grand, like the Soderling ball that's played in Stockholm. I mean, it's like that's the craziest ball there is. It's you can't hit a winner if you tried. I think the slam, usually the Grand Slam ball has it about right. I've always thought the Australian Open's played great. U.S. Open has played great. French Open. I've always thought the slams have had it pretty close to right.
Do you have a favorite ball?
I like the Wilson ball for sure.
You'd like the Wilson Extra Duty U.S. Open ball?
Yeah. I'm biased, right? I'm a somewhat of a servant, not somewhat. I am a serve guy and maybe first ball, but I definitely like to get a reward for a good shot. I think you should be rewarded for taking risk.
You over the last couple days have come out discussing the problem of doubles, that the best singles players in the world, generally speaking, don't play doubles. When they do, they often pull out. You've talked about the fact that the doubles specialists don't pull viewers. Can you explain your stance?
Yeah. I mean, I don't think anyone's really a double specialist, first of all. I mean, if you go to a junior tournament, any junior tournament, and you ask a bunch of kids playing, what do you, you know, they're a bunch of young aspiring tennis players. What are your goals? What's your end game? What do you dream of in tennis? There's not a single one that's going to tell you, I want to be a doubles specialist. They don't choose, you know, doubles. Doubles chooses them, I think. It might be harsh. I don't mean to be harsh. I'm looking at it just from a business standpoint. If you're, Craig, if you own an ATP 250, that's your only source of income. That's it. That's how you put food on the table. You don't own any other business. You know, you're not, you know, buying a tournament to sell it 5 years down the line. Even if you're operating a loss, you need revenue. You need to put money in your pocket. Would you have doubles?
I always thought that you need the doubles to fill your courts, to give people some action so that the day isn't just two matches. The day isn't just the day session and the night session isn't two matches, it's three matches, whatever it is, right?
Yeah, I mean, no one's there. At the 250 and 500 level, it's as empty as you can imagine, even the finals. That's a fact. That's just the reality of it. The Masters 1000s, you know, combined events, more people on site, more courts, you know.
Build out your thought. You said that you thought that they should have three rounds of doubles with time in between that would incentivize the singles players to play.
Yes, especially at the 250 and 500 level, the tournaments are struggling to profit, right? The ones that are really struggling to profit. The 500s have somewhat of an advantage, purely one, there's more money, more points, but you know, there's you're mandated to play. The ATP is, that's what a lot of people don't realize. We have a top 30 player. You have to play a certain amount of 500s. You have to play every Masters 1000. Otherwise, you get penalized. And if you do finish in the top 12, you don't get your bonus. So you are forced to play those weeks. You have to. So at the 250 and 500 level, I would say Friday, Saturday, Sunday, doubles. You cut the draw in half right then and there. And I would only allow the guys that are there for singles to enter the doubles draw. If you keep the same prize money pool out of those guys, I think you'll have no problem.
You're essentially saying Mektić and Pavic and Diego Hidalgo and, you know, Escobar and Skupski, these guys and Bopa, these guys can't play in pro tennis. Is that how you feel?
It's not personal. I mean, it goes back. Answer the question about the 250.
But those guys are good, man. Those guys play good doubles. Is the same problem that the Netflix show has, the same problems that the tournaments have, is that the storytelling is shoddy and shabby. And there's no reason that these cats can't be stars too. Or do you just think the single guys will just blow those guys out of the water and there's just no spot for them?
I mean, if Isner and Thok and Kyrgios Kokkinakis wanted to just dedicate their time to doubles and Thok plus one, I mean, look what Isner did last year. You know, he almost won all the Masters with different partners.
And he's 38.
Kind of walk in the park for him, some of them. Thok has barely been big Grand Slam match. He's barely even warmed up for in doubles, and he just wins 2-2. It's Hijikata and Jason Kubler paired up for the first time. I don't think they were ranked top 100 in doubles. They go out and they walk through a Grand Slam. When was the last time that's happened in singles? When was the last time a guy not in the top 50, let alone top 100, just showed up and walked through a Grand Slam?
Are you concerned that you're going to get kneecapped in the locker room? That some of these guys are going to corner you up and just be like, bro, you're taking food off the plate. What's going on here?
I could make that argument back at him. I mean,
I just mean that it's not always the best feeling to be disliked in the locker room.
Look, I'm just speaking what I feel is the truth. It's hard to debate math. It's really hard to argue with facts and math. And if they can present a point to me at the 250 and 500 level that shows that they bring in the money that it costs to have them there, let alone prize money, then perfect, I'm out. But the numbers point to me. And you look at the World Tour Finals in 2003. Look what happened. I think it was round 03. Singles and doubles separated. They went elsewhere. Separate times, separate venues. The best eight doubles teams in the world, one venue was completely empty. It was a disaster, and they couldn't. There's a reason why they merged back together. It's just the truth. It's the harsh reality. I agree. It is ruthless. I'm not doing it to take food off of someone's plate by any means. If we're looking at the economics of the sport, which is a big concern, I mean, you know, you can't have it all. People that, you know, oh, we need to help guys outside of the top 150, 100. I agree. But, you know, how do you do that? That's an example. There's one way to look at it right there.
Is the real problem appearance fees?
You got to pay guys to sell tickets.
Appearance fees are fair.
Totally. For a top guy, you can't, I mean, you have to sell tickets. If I'm in Italy, I would, of course, pay Matteo Berrettini to come play my tournament at Yannick Sinner.
Let's move into the third set. This is a portion of our show where we talk about your career. Tom Gullickson was a friend of my father's when we were kids. You know, they met at the Newport tournament. Tom and Timmy played there all the time. And, you know, I know that he's factored into your career in a very significant way. Riley, where does your tennis begin?
It begins in Palm Coast, Florida, north region of Florida, somewhat middle of nowhere. And my dad's job moved from Michigan. And
but you were born in Michigan?
Yep.
And you lived there till when?
I think it was about 6 years old.
So you're a Florida kid, kind of.
Yeah, I grew up. I'm a Florida guy for sure. You know, I moved. My dad's job moved, so the company moved, and to a small town in North Florida. And my dad met Gully, just kind of out and about in Palm Coast, and they became really good friends. And my dad didn't know anything really about tennis. He didn't know who Gully was, and you know, Gully was a Packers fan. My dad's a Bears fan, and there're not many people live in Palm Coast.
Did you start playing when you were 5, 6 years old? Did your father love tennis?
He liked tennis. He didn't know so much about it. Let's say I was playing baseball as well, and then I started. My mom put me in tennis, just right kind of down the street. There's like a group kids thing going around, and me and my sister went, and I loved it, and
you loved it.
Loved it, yeah. And then I was pretty good. I was, you know, pretty athletic kid, and had, you know, good and hand eye coordination, and definitely was natural, and played a lot. And meanwhile, like 7 or 8 months later, after I'd started playing, my dad met Gully in Palm Coast, just out and about in town, and they became really good friends. And you know, they're both from the Midwest. My dad's from Chicago, Gully's from Wisconsin, and kind of, it's a really small town in Florida. So that connection alone is somewhat significant. That's how small it is. So,
and did he start coaching you?
Not right away. I mean, my dad didn't even really tell Gully I played tennis. And, you know, Gully always tells the story. Yeah, but, you know, George, my dad's name's George. George asked, you know, me to come take a look at his kid. And my dad always says, like, love Gully's, like, that never has. I would never ask that of Gully, especially at the time. We didn't know how serious I was. And my dad always says, like, I would never ask Gully to come take. Gully's just such a nice guy. He mentioned that I was, you know, playing tennis, and I'd met him because, you know, he'd come over to the house to watch some Bears Packers games. And yeah. And then next thing you know, he got me out on the court. I think probably by the time I was 7 or 8 years old. And he, you know, I think he must have had fun and saw that I was a pretty good athlete and probably was intrigued. My dad played college basketball. I was 6'5" and 6'6", and you know, I had some size. And
where'd your father play college basketball?
He played in a Walker College and transferred to Alabama, University of Alabama, I think 2 years into it. And then, yeah, you know, I know he kind of got injured. He was a shooting guard, and my dad's a good athlete, and he picked up tennis a little bit with me. And Gully had me on court with him 3-4 days a week when he was in town. And, you know, we learned quick who he was in terms of, and, first of all, he's like second father to me. If he never charged my family a dime, never charged us a nickel. He would spend 2 hours with me, pick me up from school. I'd see his red BMW, in the car rider line. I get called as a car rider, you know, instead of taking the bus home, and see this bright red, you know, X5 BMW from Gully. I was like 10 years old, and my eyes just lit up, and he'd pick me up from school some days and take me to the course. We'd hit for 2 hours, like a mentor to me, a father, second father figure to me, and changed my life.
Were you ever like shorter than anyone else?
Nothing crazy. I was slightly above average.
And then when did you rock it?
Around 16.
16.
Yeah.
And when did you get good? When were you starting to think that you could be a pro player?
I was good when I was 12.
Oh, you were?
Yeah. Yeah. I was one of the best 12-year-olds in the country.
Did you play like the Petit A? Were you identified by the USTA, all that stuff?
I lost in the qualifiers of those. I lost to Francis.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I lost to Francis. They picked 3 or 4 guys. It's a qualifier you play for. I lost to Francis. I might have lost to Tommy. Close matches, though. And I'm trying to think of who else I was. But, yeah, I was in those events. They would bring 8 kids, and 3 of them or 4 of them would qualify. And, you know, I was short each time. So I was not of the top 4 that time. But, you know, come, like, clay courts, I beat Francis. I have a goal ball in the 12s, 14s, 16s, and 18s. So,
do you want Kalamazoo?
No, I won clay courts. And then, yeah, I won. I know I won a lot of goal balls on clay. In the 12s, I won 14s clay courts. I think I lost the final 16s clay courts to Tommy and won 18s clay courts.
When did you know you were going to play pro tennis?
You know, as a 12-year-old, like, you're somewhat delusional, right? Like, we'll joke around, and even, like, you know, if you were to ask a 12-year-old right now, like a young 12-year-old that just doesn't know anything, that's really good, one of the best 12-year-olds in the country. If I were to go up to him right now and say, hey, would you take Richard Gasquet's career? He's been top 10 forever, made a bunch of money, super well-respected, still great. 9 out of 10 of them would say probably not, right? Because they just don't know. When you're 12, you're delusional. So, yeah, right away at 12, yeah, I'm going to be a pro. And you know, how much that was, did I believe? I don't know. I was a little kid, but I definitely would say it and train like it. And then when I was 16, 17, I fell behind the pack a good bit.
Fell Francis, behind the pack.
Yeah. Tommy and Francis were two tiers ahead of me.
Two tiers.
Yeah.
How come?
During my growth spurt, I was still playing tennis the way I played when I was 13, 14. And,
yeah,
you know, playing how they play, let's say. And then I grew up and I didn't quite understand how my tennis was going to work. And actually, I remember it was one year at Kalamazoo, I think in the 16s, I had won a match, like a three-set match. And Jose Aguirre, who I always kind of respect, everyone respects his opinion. He, you know, he sat me down on the court, and I just won, and I was in the fourth round of Kalamazoo. And I remember he, you know, I won a three-set match. I thought he was going to be, you know, happy with me, which he was happy. He's never, but he said, "You have no chance of being a player playing like this, like no chance." You know, he's like,
Jose gave you the come to Jesus talk. He gave you the real talk.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, he said, you know, you got, you know, it's, yeah, great. You can hit the ball 20 times in a row in the court all the time and move around great for, but he said, you have no chance to, you know, to win like this and to be good at the next level like this. You need to be thinking long-term. And, you know, these are important years where if you stay in this, you know, I just don't see it, your game translating well to the next level. It was a tough conversation. And especially I was like in the fourth round of Kalamazoo here, you know, like, and I think that was cool that he said it even there, you know, that Kalamazoo didn't even matter at all to him, not one bit. And I remember the next match, I could make a ball in the court. I was going for broke. I lost to Mo, Michael Mo, like 2-2s, ugly tennis. And I just had no identity kind of for how I wanted to play and all this stuff. So it took me some time to figure that out, to figure out what my game was going to look like. Because obviously I'd grown a lot and, you know, tennis changes. Your arms get longer. Your reach is longer. It's tougher to stay in the point and easier to get jammed up and thrown off balance. So you have to get creative.
So what happened? You win Junior Wimbledon and then you just turn pro?
Yeah. I won Junior Wimbledon. I was good. Like, you know, I had a lot of nagging injuries, but, you know, I had won Eddie Herr without losing a set. I had, you know, I should have won Orange Bowl. I remember I was kind of playing so well. I was beating everyone and like just from playing Eddie Herr back to back, going right over to Orange Bowl back to back. And my body was just beat up at 17, but you know, it wasn't like a fluke that I won Wimbledon. You know, I was like number three in the world going into the tournament. I thought I was a favorite. Let's say I made quarters of the junior French. You know, I beat the number one player in the world there at the time. That was my first trip overseas. And then, yeah, I won Wimbledon and turn pro. It wasn't just the Wimbledon tournament that did it. You know, we'd already had some talks with Wilson and New Balance prior to Wimbledon.
You weren't cashing checks, but you were getting ready to cash some checks.
I had actually turned pro before Wimbledon. I had signed with New Balance before Junior Wimbledon, yeah. Or agreed to a contract before Junior Wimbledon.
How do you feel about your tennis and what you've done?
Yeah, I feel good. I've learned a lot. My coach, Jay Berger, has been, I mean, him and Gully have impacted me in a way you can't imagine.
But what did they do? How did you get better?
Gully was a teacher. Gully taught me technique and also made me fall in love with the game. We would watch tennis. I'd be excited to spend any second around him watching and learning from anyone and whoever. Made it so fun and taught me great mechanics and laid a great foundation. Jay taught me how to compete and how to win. And I've applied his mindset that he's taught me to tennis to life.
For our listeners, Jay Berger, a long time American player. He got to 8 in the world, I believe. In addition to being a high performance coach with the USTA for many, many, many years, his son is one of the top golfers on the PGA Tour.
Yep. Daniel Berger. Won Pebble Beach, good friend of mine. It's Jay is so special. His daughter's a doctor. It's no coincidence at all. His mindset, he was you know, not a great athlete.
But like, what can a guy like Jay Berger say to you that you think the world of him? Like, what could he tell you?
Everything.
It's one thing to be in the top 100. It's another thing to be in the top 30. But you get into the top 20, that's special. How do you get into the top 20?
I started with Jay when I was 230 in the world. And I moved from Orlando. I drove down to West Palm. He had just stopped working with Sock. And I was desperate. Things weren't panning out. I was 20 years old at that point and 230 in the world. I had way more potential than that, and things weren't working. Right away, I started with Jay. We looked at stats. We looked at what, we had a great model in front of me with John Isner. He's had a pretty good career, regardless of what people say. He's
had an incredible career. Made
$30 million in prize money. He's an unbelievable competitor. You can call him whatever you want to call him. He wins. He's a warrior, and he's an unbelievable tennis player. So we had a great model to follow. A lot of guys looked at me, a lot of coaches looked at me and said, okay, if you can break serve more than 7% of the time, if we can get you breaking 11, 12%, that's a grand slam. And we spent a lot of time prior to working with Jay, with other coaches, I spent a lot of time working on that return and trying to get there. That took away from my serve, my first ball, my forehand, my identity. With Jay, we spent time. Jay right away said, you hold serve 86% of the time. We can't have that's unacceptable. You need to be holding serve 92% of the time. You need to be winning 90% of your first serve points, 60% of your second serve points. We need to get your first serve percentage to 70%. I mean, he had the exact opposite approach. Let's work on your strengths. Let's own your strengths. Also, the other lessons that came with him, just in every aspect of life, how he applied himself. He wasn't a great athlete, didn't have a great serve, didn't have a pretty game. He was 8 in the world. He was known as an unbelievable competitor. There's great players on tour, legendary players on tour that are coaching now that come up to me, and like, your coach was nuts. That's what they'll tell me. Like, your coach was absolutely nuts in a way that, it's a compliment, and that's what he wanted to be. I mean, he wasn't like an in-your-face guy. He was just a warrior. He just competed like no other. So he's applied his mindset that he got him really good in tennis to clearly to life. Look at his daughter. Look at his son. I'd like to think – I know he's had one of the biggest roles in my life and my career. And it's not a coincidence that there's a lot of successful people around him. It's not a coincidence at all.
I watched you right from behind the court a year ago, almost to the day, it feels like, when you lost to Rafa at Indian Wells. And I didn't think you played very well. I thought you looked flat. I thought that your sort of confidence on the court seemed to really kind of waver. Who were you a year ago this week? Were you hurt? Were you – no.
No, I was one of the best players in the world. Rafa hadn't lost a match all year. I served for the second set. Somewhere with Isner. I mean, you look at John on the court, you can't judge a book by its cover out there. I thought it was a pretty good match with Rafa. It was tough conditions. It was a bit windy.
Yeah.
Super slow. That's like a brutal condition to have to play him on. And he hadn't lost yet. So he was playing pretty well. I lost 6-6, should have won the second set, served for it, got broken.
Sometimes I watch you play and I'm like, well, shit, like, how could he ever lose serve?
Yeah. And
it's like amazing that the ball comes back. It's like that slow.
Yeah. Yeah. The ball comes back. I mean, there's no doubt the ball comes back nowadays. Part of it's slower and guys are just look at some of the athletes we're seeing on tour.
So when did you come up hurt? When was that a injury that you tried to manage, or did you just snap it?
Somewhat. I mean, something happened prior to, I had a rough go. I mean, French Open, I was in the hospital for 3 nights. I had E. coli. I finished my match, first set, I started shivering out there. It was weird. I ate chicken before the match. I think it sat out, to be honest, at the French Open, and I was in the hospital. I was vomiting blood. So it was a rough couple days. I ended up staying 3 or 4 extra days than I wanted. I spent 2 nights in the American Hospital of Paris, and not fun. So I flew home feeling, super weak, super drained, tons of antibiotics, came back for Queens, and then one day at Wembley, it happened to me once before. I couldn't walk. I couldn't get out of bed. And it was my hip completely, but I could not sleep because of how much pain it was. It just out of nowhere. Before Wembley, I literally couldn't walk. And, you know, I got an MRI and we saw this, you know, it was just red hot, as inflamed as can be. And, you know, we'd already had a few calls with some hip doctors. I tried to manage it. You know, I played my match with Wimbledon somewhat, like it came around, the inflammation went down. And then, you know, prior to, you know, the hardcore series, Atlanta, I couldn't play. I tried to manage it. DC, I got an injection in there. Played DC, not well at all. The injection didn't work. And then we decided to do surgery. You know, ended up there was a benign tumor, pretty massive in the hip joint.
Yeah, labral tear.
That was causing that inflammation, that pain. So they took that out. There was some wear and tear to the labrum, which is normal in tennis. It's like a, you know, a pitcher having a, you know, some wear and tear in his elbow with all lateral movement. And so they just repaired that real quick, a 4 to 6 month recovery, smooth sailing. And you know, that was that.
When did you start leaning into the art world? When did you start leaning into the fashion world? You are unusual on tour. There's not a lot of sort of esoteric fellows.
Yeah, I started in fashion. I was so shocked coming as like somewhat of a middle America kid, you could say, you know, small town in Florida, going to Europe for the first time, you know, at junior French Open and stuff. But once I got on tour, I hated it. I was so uncomfortable there. The hotel rooms were small, old. I was miserable. And I remember I had lost, what tour I had lost in. It was Rome one year early on. And anyway, I went to the Prada Foundation in Milan. And obviously I liked fashion enough to know what, you know, to like Prada enough to want to go into their foundation. And that's where art started. And I just wanted to get away and have something to do away from tennis while I was in Europe and find a way to enjoy my time over there to help, you know, help me play better tennis. Let's say I wanted to be happier. And I got so hooked on it, and I started going to museums everywhere. I was, you know, arranging car service to take me an hour away to a museum in south of France. and, you know, Prado Museum, I was checking out of the I just started going to museums all over the place.
Now, are you a collector?
I'm a collector.
What's the story with Frederick Kunath and this Tim Van Leer friendship that you guys have? For our listeners, Frederick Kunath is a LA-based German artist, painter, who has a passion for tennis. And we see his artwork popping up here and there. And you guys have a relationship.
Yeah, Friedrich actually found his work first on Instagram. Saw he showed with Blum and Poe and Tim Van Laar Gallery. Followed Tim Van Laar, found an artist named Ben Sledsens I loved, and Rinus van de Velde, and started, you know, I inquired about a painting from Friedrich. Then I, you know, I got a painting from Freddie. I got a painting from Ben Sledsens, Kunath, Caddy Heck, Jonathan Meze, and so on and so forth. And now, you know, I go to galleries all the time. Tim, I know I'm somewhat, it's going to sound like I'm somewhat biased. Of course, I'm always biased, but Tim's program, without a doubt, is unbelievable. He found, you know, one of my favorite artists alive is a guy named Adrian Genny, who, you know, Tim was one of the original founders of. He's an unbelievable painter. And Tim's program's just nuts. He's been what goalie was to me, and tennis is what Tim was to me in art. Same with Freddie. So those guys have taught me so much. I've learned so much about history, about art, about life as well from them.
Do you like being a pro tennis player?
I do. Yeah, I do. I love my job. I absolutely love my job.
Are you a video game guy? Do you play video games all night long?
No, not at all. I read. Been reading a little bit on my downtime at night when I'm bored. I'm kind of a night owl. And I in the day, I'm always looking at art. I bring art books with me. I'm studying art. I'm studying the masters, the greats, the new guys. And yeah, it's just, I love it.
Let's move into the fourth set. This is the 10 ball scramble. I just say it, and you just say what comes in your mind. You ready?
Yep.
Do you save your credentials?
What do you mean? No.
What do you do with them? You just throw them out?
Yeah, I think they're stuck in hotel rooms.
What racket are you playing with?
Wilson Pro Staff.
6.1.
Yep, 16 by 18.
How do you string your racket?
40s, low 40s.
What string?
Alu Power 120.
That's the Lux Salon.
Yep.
Have you always been a Lux player? You always play with the Lux?
Always.
Size of your grip?
4 5/8.
Leather grip with a Turner grip over it? No.
Nope. Cushion with a white Wilson grip.
It seems like not a lot of players are playing Wilson anymore. Tommy switched. Have you always been a Wilson player?
Since I was a little guy.
Same racket forever?
Yep, same racket. K-Factor, 6195. Haven't gone back since.
The ATP.
I mean, I look at it as a somewhat of a joke, right? I look at it as a kind of a poorly run business.
The WTA.
Great product, great talent, poorly run business. Hence the CVC deal.
The PTPA.
Up and coming, potential, but needs to get the ball rolling, needs to get moving.
LIV Golf.
Groundbreaking in some regards, mistakes made in other regards. Innovative for sure.
Your favorite player to watch?
I like watching players that I root for that I just grew up idolizing. Venus and Isner.
Prize money.
It could be a lot better.
Big entourage or lean and mean?
Lean and mean.
How many do you travel with?
3.
Who?
2. Wolfgang Oswald, Jay Berger. I don't have a traveling coach anymore. Coach, physio, and then sometimes an artist.
TUEs, therapeutic use exemptions.
Adderall, baby.
Would that be fair to say that that's a real problem? Guys are cheating with Adderall.
Of course. It's an amphetamine. Should be banned. Shouldn't be allowed.
Medical timeouts.
You need them sometimes. Yeah. You need a tape job. You need things, but you can't. It's a hard one to just give one word on.
Coaching.
I don't like it.
Let's move into the fifth and final set. This is the king of the court. If you could be the king of tennis and make changes in the sport with just a swing of the racket, I know you got a lot, so I'm just going to ask you, what would your tip-top, top-level change be?
There'd be a lot. I mean, first things first, I'd cut out a lot of the guys that have media credentials. The Rothenbergs, the Jerry Margazis or whatever the world. They disagree with me and I get called a lumberjack. They go after my appearance. That's just how ridiculous some of these guys are. You can't, it's 2023. You can't make fun of my appearance and attack the way I look just because you disagree with what I'm saying. I thought we were kind of behind that. These are grown men.
I think you read that wrong. That was not a dig.
Yeah, but it's a little weird.
But he just was just sort of describing your beard. But to your point, you feel like the media doesn't do a good job. What has Ben done that you think he shouldn't be allowed in the room?
First of all, the way he's gone after Novak is very strange to me. I've seen tweets of his hashtag ATP suspend a white guy challenge. You know, I've seen him do interviews with Kokkinakis and Kyrgios asking him about touching the other guy's butt. Like, that's just strange. It's poor journalism. Same with the other. You shouldn't go after someone's appearance. That's tennis for you. That a guy with a beard is so shocking in tennis that's like what he's going to go at. I mean, it's just, you just cut used to the same cookie cutter kind of person. And if I don't act the same cookie cutter way. You know what I mean? Like, just because you disagree with me doesn't mean you should go after someone's appearance or take it so personal like that. But whatever.
We have to discuss this just for a second. I didn't want to dig into this, but your issue more than him mentioning your beard, which I did not read as a dig, was that you said that you oppose doubles. And then he said, well, no, doubles is great. And then he referenced two singles players playing doubles out of the two, like, very popular people. That was exciting. That was really your premise of your issue.
A few things. Yeah. Coco Gauff could have
she's a big star.
She could have a thumb wrestling match with her younger brother, and Arthur Ashe is going to be packed. So that's just a invalid argument. The other argument, you know, people make is, oh, you, no one watches you. You're super boring to watch. You don't sell tickets, blah, blah, blah. You know, so should you be scrapped? Well, first of all, I mean, me and Isner are the two most miserable guys to watch. That's, you know, I get that. We played in February in Long Island in the middle of nowhere in freezing cold. No one even wanted to leave their house. We still had a pretty full house. And Houston, same thing, full house. Dallas, full house. Whatever, I get it. We're boring. The argument's still not valid. Also, you need someone for the ticket sellers to play again. Yeah, you might hate watching me play. That's fine. I get it. I actually understand that. But for some reason, when I play Rafa, I play Medvedev, I play Sinner, I play Tsitsipas, I play Berrettini, there seems to be a lot of people there. Are they watching me? Are they? No, they're there. Maybe they're there for them. But you need someone for the ticket sellers to play against. And that's what people don't get. And that's, they keep using that. And now that's not a valid argument either. So, yeah, there's a lot of things I would change. One, I would start with who qualifies as a journalist and who has access to the players and what their agenda really is. And two, I would, you know, I mentioned, you know, kind of what I said with doubles, and three, I would fight for transparency. I would want transparency all around in the sport. That's the number one. That's how sports move forward. That's how business moves forward. We don't know. We don't see the Masters 1000's books. I guarantee you right now. So the ATP just did a deal, you know, the new Masters 1000's deal. Players have a split with, you know, net revenue. That's like the biggest sucker deal in sports. So I guarantee you that, you know, basically what that means is one of these tournaments, some of these Masters are going to do a multi-million dollar renovation to their stadium. Because it's just a sucker deal for talent. That's a known fact. Who does a net revenue deal? That's insane. Like, that's absolutely nuts. That doesn't exist in other sports. So that's a concern. That's a small detail. That's a concern. You know, look who our CEOs are. Look at Chris Kermode was a teaching pro. How do you go from being a teaching pro to CEO of one of the biggest international sports in the world? Same with, you know, Massimo. I no offense, not personal, but, you know, he was sending me Wilson grips not too long ago. How do you go from that to being that level exec of one of the biggest international sports in the world?
For our listeners, Massimo Cavalli, the number two at the ATP under Andrea Gaudenzi.
You know, I think that we need a visionary I think we've gone too close to tennis minds when hiring CEOs. How does a teaching pro know how to run one of the biggest international sports in the world? I mean, I'm sorry, it's not a personal dig. It's just, I'm not trying to be mean. Those are facts. That's a very valid question. And in today's day and age, that's looked at as controversial and whatever. It is what it is. I'll call it like it is. But I think similar, we have a great product. I think the ATP and the WTA is a great product right now. That's a fact. I watch more women's tennis than ever. I think the talent is off the charts. Same on the ATP. And I think, you know, you can't compare tennis, let's say, to a tech company, but look at Uber, for example. It's transcended our daily life. I Uber Eats all the time. I Uber everywhere. I can go everywhere. Great product. They lost $9 billion last year. So, I mean, it can be as great of a product as there is, but if there's not a great business model, you know, you can't fix that. That's a problem in itself. So I think similar in that regard, you know, I think we have a great product all around, with a really poor business model that lacks transparency, that is far from a 50-50 partnership, that players have gotten the short end of the stick for the last 50 years.
Riley Opelka speaking truth to power, not always the most popular thing to do. My man, will we see you floating around Miami? Do you have any sponsorship obligations or anything? You going to come watch the tennis? No.
No, I'm not going to float around Miami. It's a great tournament. I'll watch from my couch. I'm a little more comfortable. There's a little more leg room for me from my own couch than in a
Come on, man. You ain't going to go down there and just get in get a luxury box and some pop the Cristal and watch Tommy Paul?
No, I wish, man. I wish.
I don't know why you tennis guys won't show up at the tournament when you're not playing. Just to you watch a little tennis, press the flesh, no?
We play 35 weeks a year. We travel 11. We play every day. Consume our whole life since we were 6 years old. We can live without it for a couple days.
Listen, pleasure having you. Safe flight later today back to Florida. I hope you get better. You know, I know you guys call yourself serve bots, but I think you're a lot more than that.
Thank you.
Riley Opelka, you are released. Huge thank you to Riley Opelka. Thank you to Diodora. See them at Diodora.com and be on the lookout as there will be more to come. Megan Fernandez edited the show. Our music is by Brian Senti. We'll be back next time with more of the most interesting voices in the sport. Until then, I'm Craig Shapiro, and you are released.